drained as we both were. It was as though we were suspended together in a place where neither time nor consequence existed. There was room for nothing but truth between us. He sighed.
Everyone has a colour about them, he said simply, all around them like a cloud. Yours is blue, Madonna, like the Virgin's cloak, like my own.
The gauze curtain fluttered briefly, and he was gone. Chapter 26 Fontainebleau. For several days I slept. Whether this was a necessary part of physical recovery or a stubborn retreat from waking reality, I don't know. But I woke only reluctantly to take a little food, falling at once back into a stupor of oblivion, as though the small, warm weight of broth in my stomach were an anchor that pulled me after it, down through the murky fathoms of sleep. A few days later, I woke to the sound of insistent voices near my ear, and the touch of hands lifting me from the bed. The arms that held me were strong and masculine, and for a moment I felt a floating joy. Then I woke all the way, struggling feebly against a wave of tobacco and cheap wine, to find myself in the grasp of Hugo, Louise de la Tour's enormous footman. "Put me down," I said, batting at him weakly. He looked startled at this sudden resurrection from the dead and nearly dropped me. But a high, commanding voice stopped both of us. "Claire, my dear friend, do not be afraid, ma chère. It's all right. I'm taking you to Fontainebleau. The air and good food, it's what you need. And rest. You need rest." I blinked against the light like a newborn lamb. Louise's face, round, pink, and anxious, floated nearby like a cherub on a cloud. Mother Hildegard stood behind her, tall and stern as the angel at the gates of Eden, the heavenly illusion enhanced by the fact that they were both standing in front of the stained-glassed window in the vestibule of the hôpital.
"Yes," she said,
her deep voice making the simplest word more emphatic than all Louise's twittering.
"It will be good for you. Au revoir, my dear."
And with that, I was borne down the steps of the hôpital and stuffed willy-nilly into Louise's coach, with neither strength nor will to protest. The bumping of the coach over potholes and ruts kept me awake on the journey to Fontainebleau. That and Louise's constant conversation aimed at reassurance. At first I made some dazed attempt to respond, but soon realised that she required no answers, and in fact talked more easily without them. After days in the cool grey stone vault of the hôpital, I felt like a freshly unwrapped mummy, and shrank from the assault of so much brightness and colour. I found it easier to deal with if I drew back a bit, and let it all wash past me without trying to distinguish its elements. This strategy worked until we reached a small wood just outside Fontainebleau. The trunks of the oaks were dark and thick, with low spreading canopies that shadowed the ground beneath with shifting light, so that the whole wood seemed to be moving slightly in the wind. I was vaguely admiring the effect when I noticed that some of what I had assumed to be tree trunks were, in fact, moving, turning very slowly to and fro. "Louise!" My exclamation and my grip on her arm stopped her chatter in mid-word. She lunged heavily across me to see what I was looking at, then flopped back to her side of the carriage and thrust her head out of the window, shouting at the coachman. We came to a slithering, dusty halt just opposite the wood. There were three of them, two men and a woman. Louise's high, agitated voice went on expostulating and questioning, punctuated by the coachman's attempts to explain or apologise. But I paid no attention. In spite of their turning and the small fluttering of their clothing, they were very still, more inert than the trees that held them. The faces were black with suffocation. "Monsieur Foray wouldn't have approved at all," I thought through the haze of shock. An amateur execution, but effective for all that. The wind shifted, and a faint, gassy stink blew over us.
Louise shrieked and pounded on the window frame in a frenzy of indignation, and the carriage started with a jerk that rocked her back in the seat. "Merde," she said, rapidly fanning her flushed face. "The idiocy of that fool stopping like that right there. What recklessness! The shock of it is bad for the baby, I'm sure, and you, my poor dear. Oh, dear, my poor Claire, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to remind you. How can you forgive me? I'm so tactless." Luckily, her agitation at possibly having upset me made her forget her own upset at the sight of the bodies, but it was very wearying trying to stem her apologies. At last, in desperation, I changed the subject back to the hanged ones.
"Who?"
The distraction worked. She blinked, and remembering the shock to her système, pulled out a bottle of ammoniac spirits and took a hearty sniff that made her sneeze in reflex.
"Hugh-choo!
Huguenots," she got out, snorting and wheezing. "Protestant heretics, that's what the coachman says."
"They hang them? Still?"
Somehow I had thought such religious persecution a relic of earlier times.
"Well, not just for being Protestants, usually,
though that's enough," Louise said, sniffing. She dabbed her nose delicately with an embroidered handkerchief, examined the results critically, then reapplied the cloth to her nose and blew it with a satisfying honk.
"Ah, that's better."
She tucked the handkerchief back in her pocket and leaned back with a sigh.
"Now I am restored. What a shock. If they have to hang them, that's all well. But must they do so by a public thoroughfare where ladies must be exposed to such disgustingness? Did you smell them? Phew! This is the Comte Médard's land. I'll send him a very nasty letter about it. See if I don't."
"But why did they hang these people?" I asked, interrupting in the brutal manner that was the only possible way of actually conversing with Louise.
"Oh, witchcraft, most likely. There was a woman, you saw. Usually it's witchcraft when the women are involved. If it's only men, most often it's just preaching sedition and heresy. But the women don't preach. Did you see the ugly dark clothes she had on? Horrible. So depressing only to wear dark colours all the time. What kind of religion would make its followers wear such plain clothes all the time? Obviously the devil's work. Anyone can see that. They are afraid of women. That's what it is. So they..."
I closed my eyes and leaned back in the seat. I hoped it wasn't very far to Louise's country house. In addition to the monkey, from whom she would not be parted, Louise's country house contained a number of other decorations of dubious taste. In Paris, her husband's taste and her father's must be consulted, and the rooms of the house there were consequently done richly, but in subdued tones. But Jules seldom came to the country house, being too busy in the city, so Louise's taste was allowed free rein. "This is my newest toy. Is it not lovely?" she cooed, running her hand lovingly over the carved dark wood of a tiny house that sprouted incongruously from the wall next to a gilt bronze sconce in the shape of Eurydice.
"That looks like a cuckoo clock," I said disbelievingly. "You have seen one before? I didn't think there were any to be found anywhere in Paris."
Louise pouted slightly at the thought that her toy might not be unique, but brightened as she twisted the hands of the clock to the next hour. She stood back, beaming proudly, as the tiny clockwork bird stuck its head out and emitted several shrill cuckoos in succession.
"Isn't it precious?"
She touched the bird's head briefly as it disappeared back into its hidey-hole.
"Berthe, the housekeeper here, got it for me. Her brother brought it all the way from Switzerland. Whatever you want to say about the Swiss, they are clever woodcarvers, no?"
I wanted to say no, but instead merely murmured something tactfully admiring. Louise's grasshopper mind leapt nimbly to a new topic, possibly triggered by thoughts of Swiss servants.
"You know Claire," she said with a touch of reproof. You ought really to come to Mass in the chapel each morning.
Why? She tossed her head in the direction of the doorway where one of the maids was passing with a tray.
I don't care at all myself, but the servants. They're very superstitious out here in the countryside, you know. And one of the footmen from the Paris house was foolish enough to tell the cook all about that silly story of your being La Dame Blanche. I've told them that's all nonsense, of course, and threatened to dismiss anyone I catch spreading such gossip, but, well, it might help if you came to Mass, or at least prayed out loud now and then, so they could hear you.
Unbeliever that I was, I thought daily Mass in the house's chapel might be going a bit far, but with vague amusement agreed to do what I could to allay the servants' fears. Consequently, Louise and I spent the next hour reading psalms aloud to each other and reciting the Lord's Prayer in unison, loudly. I had no idea what effect this performance might have on the servants, but it did at least exhaust me sufficiently that I went up to my room for a nap and slept without dreaming until the next morning. I often had difficulty sleeping, possibly because my waking state was little different from an uneasy doze. I lay awake at night, gazing at the white gesso ceiling with its furbishes of fruit and flowers. It hung above me like a dim grey shape in the darkness, the personification of the depression that clouded my mind by day. When I did close my eyes at night, I dreamed. I couldn't block the dreams with greyness. They came in vivid colours to assault me in the dark. And so I seldom slept. There was no word from Jamie, or of him. Whether it was guilt or injury that had kept him from coming to me at the hôpital, I didn't know. But he hadn't come, nor did he come to Fontainebleau. By now he had likely left for Orvieto. Sometimes I found myself wondering when, or whether, I would see him again, and what, if anything, we might say to each other. But for the most part I preferred not to think about it, letting the days come and go one by one, avoiding thoughts of both the future and the past by living only in the present. Deprived of his idol, Fergus drooped. Again and again I saw him from my window, sitting disconsolately beneath a hawthorn bush in the garden, hugging his knees and looking down the road toward Paris. At last I stirred myself to go out to him, making my way heavily downstairs and down the garden path. "Can't you find anything to do, Fergus?" I asked him. "Surely one of the stable lads could use a hand or something?"
"Yes, me lady,"
he agreed doubtfully. He scratched absent-mindedly at his buttocks. I observed this behaviour with deep suspicion. "Fergus," I said, folding my arms, "have you got lice?" He snatched his hand back as though burned.
"Oh, no, me lady."
I reached down and pulled him to his feet, sniffed delicately in his general vicinity, and put a finger inside his collar, far enough to reveal the grimy ring around his neck. "Bath," I said succinctly.
"No."
He jerked away, but I grabbed him by the shoulder. I was surprised by his vehemence. While no fonder of bathing than the normal Parisian, who regarded the prospect of immersion with a repugnance akin to horror, still, I could hardly reconcile the usually obliging child I knew with the little fury that suddenly squirmed and twisted under my hand. There was a ripping noise, and he was free, bounding through the blackberry bushes like a rabbit pursued by a weasel. There was a rustle of leaves and a scrabble of stones, and he was gone, over the wall, and headed for the outbuildings at the back of the estate. I made my way through the maze of rickety outbuildings behind the chateau, cursing under my breath as I skirted mud puddles and heaps of filth. Suddenly there was a high-pitched whining buzz, and a cloud of flies rose from the pile a few feet ahead of me, bodies sparking blue in the sunlight. I wasn't close enough to have disturbed them. There must have been some movement from the darkened doorway beside the dung heap. "Aha!" I said out loud. got you, you filthy little son of a what-not. Come out of there this instant.
No one emerged, but there was an audible stir inside the shed, and I thought I caught a glimpse of white in the shadowed interior. Holding my nose, I stepped over the manure pile into the shed. There were two gasps of horror. Mine, at beholding something that looked like the wild man of Borneo, flattened against the back wall, and his, at beholding me. The sunlight trickled through the cracks between the boards, giving enough light for us to see each other clearly, once my eyes had adapted to the relative dark. He wasn't, after all, quite as awful-looking as I'd thought at first, but he wasn't a lot better, either. His beard was as filthy and matted as his hair, flowing past his shoulders onto a shirt ragged as any beggar's. He was barefoot, and if the term sans culotte wasn't yet in common use, it wasn't for lack of trying on his part. I wasn't afraid of him, because he was so obviously afraid of me. He was pressing himself against the wall as though trying to get through it by osmosis. "It's all right," I said soothingly. "I won't hurt you." Instead of being soothed, he drew himself abruptly upright, reached into the bosom of his shirt, and pulled out a wooden crucifix on a leather thong. He held this out toward me and started praying, in a voice shaking with terror. "Oh, bother," I said crossly. "Not another one." I took a deep breath. "Pater noster qui es in caeli et in terra." His eyes bugged out, and he kept holding the crucifix, but at least he stopped his own praying in response to this performance. "Amen," I concluded with a gasp. I held up both hands and waggled them in front of his face. "See? Not a word backward. Didn't even have my fingers crossed. So I can't be a witch, can I?" The man slowly lowered his crucifix and stood gaping at me. "A witch?" he said. He looked as though he thought I were crazy, which I felt was a bit thick under the circumstances. "You didn't think I was a witch?" I said, beginning to feel a trifle foolish. Something that looked like a smile twitched into existence and out again among the tangles of his beard. "No, madame," he said. "I am accustomed to people saying such things of me."
"You are?"
I eyed him closely. Besides the rags and filth, the man was obviously starving. The wrists that stuck out of his shirt were scrawny as a child's. At the same time, his French was graceful and educated, if oddly accented.
"If you're a witch," I said, "you aren't very successful at it. Who the hell are you?"
At this, the fright came back into his eyes again. He looked from side to side, seeking escape, but the shed was solidly built, if old, with no entrance other than the one in which I was standing. At last, calling on some hidden reserve of courage, he drew himself up to his full height, some 3 inches below my own, and with great dignity said,
"I am the Reverend Walter Laurent of Geneva."
"You're a priest!"
I was thunderstruck. I couldn't imagine what might have brought a priest, Swiss or not, to this state. Father Laurent looked nearly as horror-struck as I.
"A priest!" he echoed. "A papist! Never!"
Suddenly the truth struck me.
"A Huguenot," I said. "That's it. You're a Protestant, aren't you?"
I remembered the bodies I had seen hanging in the forest. That, I thought, explained rather a lot. His lips quivered, but he pressed them tightly together for a moment before opening them to reply.
"Yes, madame. I am a pastor. I've been preaching in this district for a month."
He licked his lips briefly, eyeing me.
"Your pardon, madame. I think you are not French."
"I'm English," I said, and he relaxed suddenly, as though someone had taken all the stiffening out of his spine.
"Great Father in heaven," he said prayerfully. "You are then a Protestant also?"
"No, I'm a Catholic," I answered. "But I'm not at all vicious about it," I added hastily, seeing the look of alarm spring back into his light brown eyes.
Don't worry. I won't tell anyone you're here. I suppose you came to try to steal a little food? I asked sympathetically.
To steal is a sin, he said, horrified. No, madame, but...
He clamped his lips shut, but his glance in the direction of the chateau gave him away.
So one of the servants brings you food, I said. So you let them do the stealing for you. But then I suppose you can absolve them from the sin, so it all works out. Rather thin moral ice you're on, if you ask me, I said reprovingly. But then it isn't any of my business, I suppose.
A light of hope shone in his eyes.
You mean you will not have me arrested, madame?
No, of course not. I've a sort of fellow feeling for fugitives from the law, having come rather close to being burnt at the stake once myself. I didn't know why I was being so chatty. The relief of meeting someone who seemed intelligent, I supposed. Louise was sweet, devoted, and kind, and had precisely as much brain as the cuckoo clock in her drawing-room. Thinking of the Swiss clock, I suddenly realized who Pastor Laurent's secret parishioners must be.
Look, I said, if you want to stay here, I'll go up to the chateau and tell Berthe or Maurice that you're here.
The poor man was nothing but skin, bones, and eyes. Everything he thought was reflected in those large, gentle brown orbs. Right now, he was plainly thinking that whoever had tried to burn me at the stake had been on the right track.
I have heard, he began slowly, reaching for a fresh grip on his crucifix, of an Englishwoman, whom the Parisians call La Dame Blanche, an associate of Raymond the Heretic.
I sighed. That's me, though I'm not an associate of Master Raymond's, I don't think. He's just a friend. Seeing him squint doubtfully at me, I inhaled again.
Pater Nostra.
No, no, madame, please. To my surprise, he had lowered the crucifix and was smiling.
I also am an acquaintance of Master Raymond's, whom I knew in Geneva. There he was a reputable physician and herbalist. Now, alas, I fear that he has turned to darker pursuits, though, of course, nothing was proved.
Proved? About what? And what's all this about Raymond the Heretic?
You did not know.
Thin brows lifted over the brown eyes.
Ah, then you are not associated with Master Raymond's activities.
He relaxed noticeably. Activity seemed like a poor description for the way in which Raymond had healed me, so I shook my head.
No, but I wish you'd tell me.
Oh, but I shouldn't be standing here talking. I should go and send Berthe with food. He waved a hand with some dignity.
It is of no urgency, madame. The appetites of the body are of no importance when weighed against the appetites of the soul. And Catholic or not, you have been kind to me. If you are not now associated with Master Raymond's occult activities, then it is right that you should be warned in time.
And ignoring the dirt and the splintered boards of the floor, he folded his legs and sat down against the wall of the shed, gracefully motioning me also to sit. Intrigued, I collapsed opposite him, tucking up the folds of my skirt to keep them from dragging in the manure.
"Have you heard of a man named Du Carrefour, madame?"
the pastor said.
"No? Well, his name is well known in Paris, I assure you. But you would do well not to speak it. This man was the organizer and the leader of a ring of unspeakable vice and depravity, in association with the most debased occult practices. I cannot bring myself to mention to you some of the ceremonies that were performed in secret among the nobility." "And they call me a witch," he muttered, almost under his breath.
He raised one bony forefinger, as though to forestall my unspoken objection.
"I am aware, madame, of the sort of gossip that is commonly spread without reference to fact. Who should know it better than we? But the activities of Du Carrefour and his followers, these are a matter of common knowledge, for he was tried for them, imprisoned and eventually burned in the Place de la Bastille as punishment for his crimes.
I remembered Raymond's light remark. No one's been burned in Paris in, 20 years at least, and shuddered, in spite of the warm weather.
And you say that Master Raymond was associated with this Du Carrefour?
The pastor frowned, scratching absently at his matted beard. He likely had both lice and fleas, I thought, and tried to move back imperceptibly.
Well, it is difficult to say. No one knows where Master Raymond came from. He speaks several tongues, all without noticeable accent. A very mysterious man, Master Raymond, but I would swear by the name of my God, a good one.
I smiled at him. I think so, too. He nodded, smiling, but then grew serious as he resumed his story.
Just so, madame. Still, he corresponded with Du Carrefour from Geneva. I know this, for he told me so himself. He supplied various substances to order. Plants, elixirs, the dried skins of animals, even a sort of fish. A most peculiar and frightening thing, which he told me was brought up from the darkest depths of the sea. A horrible thing, all teeth, with almost no flesh, but with the most horrifying small lights, like tiny lanterns, beneath its eyes.
Really? I said, fascinated. Pastor Laurent shrugged.
All this may be quite innocent, of course, a mere matter of business. But he disappeared from Geneva at the same time that Du Carrefour came at first under suspicion. And within weeks of Du Carrefour's execution, I had begun to hear stories that Master Raymond had established his business in Paris, and that he had taken over a number of Du Carrefour's clandestine activities as well.
"Hmm," I said. I was thinking of Raymond's inner room and the cabinet painted with cabalistic signs.
To keep out those who believed in them.
Anything else?
The Reverend Laurent's eyebrows arched skyward. No, madame, he said rather weakly. Nothing else, to my knowledge.
Well, I'm really not given to that sort of thing myself, I assured him.
Oh, good,
he said hesitantly. He sat silently for a moment, as though making up his mind about something, then inclined his head courteously toward me.
You will pardon me if I intrude, madame. Berta and Maurice have told me something of your loss. I'm sorry, madame.
Thank you, I said, staring at the stripes of sunlight on the floor. There was another silence. Then Pastor Laurent said delicately,
Your husband, madame, he is not here with you.
No, I said, still keeping my eyes on the floor. Flies lighted momentarily, then zoomed off, finding no nourishment. I don't know where he is. I didn't mean to say any more, but something made me look up at the ragged little preacher. He cared more for his honour than he did for me, or his child, or an innocent man, I said bitterly. I don't care where he is. I never want to see him again. I stopped abruptly, shaken. I hadn't put it into words before, even to myself. But it was true. There had been a great trust between us, and Jamie had broken it for the sake of revenge. I understood. I had seen the power of the thing that drove him, and knew it couldn't be denied forever. But I had asked for a few months' grace, which he had promised me. And then, unable to wait, he had broken his word, and by so doing sacrificed everything that lay between him and me. Not only that, he had jeopardized the undertaking in which we were engaged. I could understand, but I wouldn't forgive. Pastor Laurent laid a hand on mine. It was grimy with crusted dirt, and his nails were broken and black-edged, but I didn't draw away. I expected platitudes or a homily, but he didn't speak either, just held my hand very gently for a long time, as the sun moved across the floor and the flies buzzed slow and heavy past our heads.
"You had better go," he said at last, releasing my hand. "You will be missed."
"I suppose so." I drew a deep breath, feeling at least steadier, if not better. I felt in the pocket of my gown. I had a small purse with me. I hesitated, not wanting to offend him. After all, by his lights, I was a heretic, even if not a witch.
"Will you let me give you some money?" I asked carefully.
He thought for a moment, then smiled, the light brown eyes glowing.
"On one condition, madame, if you will allow me to pray for you."
"A bargain," I said, and gave him the purse. Chapter 27. An Audience with His Majesty. As the days passed at Fontainebleau, I gradually regained my bodily strength, though my mind continued to drift, my thoughts shying away from any sort of memory or action. There were few visitors. The country house was a refuge, where the frenetic social life of Paris seemed like one more of the uneasy dreams that haunted me. I was surprised, then, to have a maid summon me to the drawing-room to meet a visitor. The thought crossed my mind that it might be Jamie, and I felt a surge of dizzying sickness. But then reason reasserted itself. Jamie must have left for Spain by now. He could not possibly return before late August. And when he did? I couldn't think of it. I pushed the idea into the back of my mind, but my hand shook as I fastened my laces to go downstairs. Much to my surprise, the visitor was Magnus, the butler from Jared's Paris house.
"Your pardon, madame," he said, bowing deeply when he saw me. "I did not wish to presume. But I could not tell whether perhaps the matter was of importance, and with the master gone."
Lordly in his own sphere of influence, the old man was badly discomposed by being so far afield. It took some time to extract a coherent story from him, but at length a note was produced, folded and sealed, addressed to me.
"The hand is that of Monsieur Meurtor," Magnus said, in a tone of half-repugnant awe.
That explained his hesitance, I thought. The servants in the Paris house all regarded Meurtor with a sort of respectful horror, which had been exaggerated by reports of the events in the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré. It had come to the Paris house 2 weeks earlier, Magnus explained. Unsure what to do with it, the servants had dithered and conferred, but at length he had decided that it must be brought to my attention.
"The master being gone," he repeated.
This time I paid attention to what he was saying. "Gone?" I said. The note was crumpled and stained from its journey, light as a leaf in my hand.
"You mean Jamie left before this note arrived?"
I could make no sense of this. This must be Murtaugh's note giving the name and sailing date of the ship that would bear Charles Stuart's port from Lisbon. Jamie couldn't have left for Spain before receiving the information. As though to verify this, I broke the seal and unfolded the note. It was addressed to me because Jamie had thought there was less chance of my mail being intercepted than his. From Lisbon, dated nearly a month before. The letter boasted no signature, but didn't need one. "The Scalamandre sails from Lisbon on the 18th of July," was all the note said. I was surprised to see what a small, neat hand Meurtor wrote. Somehow I had been expecting a formless scrawl. I looked up from the paper to see Magnus and Louise exchanging a very odd kind of look.
"What is it?" I said abruptly. "Where's Jamie?"
I had put down his absence from L'Hôpital des Anges after the miscarriage to his guilt at the knowledge that his reckless action had killed our child, had killed Frank, and had nearly cost me my life. At that point, I didn't care. I didn't want to see him either. Now I began to think of another, more sinister explanation for his absence. It was Louise who spoke at last, squaring her plump shoulders to the task.
"He's in the Bastille," she said, taking a deep breath. "For dueling."
My knees felt watery, and I sat down on the nearest available surface.
"Why in hell didn't you tell me?"
I wasn't sure what I felt at this news. Shock or horror? Fear? Or a small sense of satisfaction?
I
I didn't want to upset you, chérie, Louise stammered, taken aback at my apparent distress. You were so weak, and there was nothing you could do after all.
And you didn't ask, she pointed out.
But what... How long is the sentence? I demanded.
Whatever my initial emotion, it was superseded by a sudden rush of urgency. Murtaugh's note had arrived at the Rue Trémoulin 2 weeks ago. Jamie should have left upon its receipt, but he hadn't.
Louise was summoning servants and ordering wine and ammoniac spirits and burnt feathers all at once. I must look rather alarming.
"It is a contravention of the king's order," she said, pausing in her flutter. "He will remain in prison at the king's pleasure."
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I muttered, wishing I had something stronger to say.
"It is fortunate that Le Petit Jean did not kill his opponent," Louise hastened to add.
"In that case, the penalty would have been much more..."
She twitched her striped skirts aside just in time to avoid the cascade of chocolate and biscuits as I knocked over the newly arrived refreshments. The tray clanged to the floor unregarded as I stared down at her. My hands were clasped tightly against my ribs, the right protectively curled over the gold ring on my left hand. The thin metal seemed to burn against my skin.
"He isn't dead, then?" I asked, like one in a dream.
"Captain Randall? He's alive?"
"Why, yes," she said, peering curiously up at me. "You did not know? He's badly wounded, but it is said that he recovers. Are you quite well, Claire? You look..."
But the rest of what she was saying was lost in the roaring that filled my ears.
"You did too much too soon," Louise said severely, pulling back the curtains. "I said so, didn't I?"
"I imagine so," I said. I sat up and swung my legs out of bed, checking cautiously for any residual signs of faintness. No swimming of head, ringing of ears, double vision, or inclination to fall on the floor. Vital signs all right. "I need my yellow gown, and then would you send for the carriage, Louise?" I asked. Louise looked at me in horror.
"You are not meaning to go out? Nonsense! Monsieur Clouseau is coming to attend you. I've sent a messenger to fetch him here at once."
The news that Monsieur Clouseau, a prominent society physician, was coming from Paris to examine me, would have been sufficient grounds to get me on my feet, had I needed them. The 18th of July was 10 days away. With a fast horse, good weather, and a disregard for bodily comfort, the journey from Paris to Orvieto could be made in 6. That left me 4 days to contrive Jamie's release from the Bastille. No time to fiddle about with Monsieur Clouseau. I said, looking round the room thoughtfully.
"Well, call the maid to dress me at any rate.
I don't want Monsieur Clouseau to find me in my shift." Though she still looked suspicious, this sounded plausible. Most ladies of the court would rise from a deathbed in order to make sure they were dressed appropriately for the occasion.
"All right," she agreed, turning to go. "But you stay in bed until Yvonne arrives, you hear?"
The yellow gown was one of my best, a loose, graceful thing, made in the modish sack style, with a wide rolled collar, full sleeves, and a beaded closure down the front. Powdered, combed, stockinged, and perfumed at last, I surveyed the pair of shoes Yvonne had laid out for me to step into. I turned my head this way and that, frowning appraisingly. No, I said at last. "I don't think so. I wear the others, the ones with the red Morocco heels, instead." The maid looked dubiously at my dress, as though mentally assessing the effect of red Morocco with yellow moiré silk, but obediently turned to rummage in the foot of the huge armoire. Tiptoeing silently up behind her in my stocking feet, I shoved her headfirst into the armoire and slammed the door on the heaving, shrieking mass beneath the pile of fallen dresses within. Turning the key in the door, I dropped it neatly into my pocket, mentally shaking hands with myself. "Neat job, Beecham," I thought.
All this political intrigue is teaching you things they never dreamt of in nursing school. No doubt about it. Don't worry, I told the shaking armoire soothingly. Someone will be along to let you out soon, I imagine. And you can tell La Princesse that you didn't let me go anywhere. A despairing wail from inside the armoire seemed to be mentioning Monsieur Clouseau's name. Tell him to have a look at the monkey, I called over my shoulder. It's got mange. The success of my encounter with Yvonne buoyed my mood. Once ensconced in the carriage, rattling back toward Paris, though, my spirits sank appreciably. While I was no longer quite so angry at Jamie, I still didn't wish to see him. My feelings were in complete turmoil, and I had no intention of examining them closely. It hurt too much. Grief was there, and a horrible sense of failure, and over all the sense of betrayal, his and mine. He should never have gone to the Bois de Boulogne. I should never have gone after him. But we both did, as our natures and our feelings dictated, and together we had, perhaps, caused the death of our child. I had no wish to meet my partner in the crime, still less to expose my grief to him, to match my guilt with his. I fled from anything that reminded me of the dripping morning in the Bois. Certainly I fled from any memory of Jamie, caught as I had last seen him, rising from the body of his victim, face glowing with the vengeance that would shortly claim his own family. I couldn't think of it even in passing, without a terrible clenching in my stomach that brought back the ghost of the pain of premature labour. I pressed my fists into the blue velvet of the carriage seat, raising myself to ease the imagined pressure on my back. I turned to look out the window, hoping to distract myself, but the sights went blindly by as my mind returned unbidden to thoughts of my journey. Whatever my feelings for Jamie, whether we would ever see each other again, what we might be or not be to one another, still the fact remained that he was in prison. And I rather thought I knew just what imprisonment might mean to him, with the memories of Wentworth that he carried, the groping hands that fondled him in dreams, the stone walls he hammered in his sleep. More importantly, there was a matter of Charles and the ship from Portugal, the loan from Monsieur Duveny, and Murtor about to take ship from Lisbon for a rendezvous off Orvieto. The stakes were too high to allow my own emotions any play. For the sake of the Scottish clans and the Highlands themselves, for Jamie's family and tenants at Lallybroch, for the thousands who would die at Culloden and in its aftermath, it had to be tried. And to try, Jamie would have to be free. It wasn't something I could undertake myself. No, there was no question. I would have to do whatever I must to have him released from the Bastille. And just what could I do? I watched the beggars scramble and gesture toward the windows as we entered the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré. When in doubt, I thought, seek the assistance of our higher authority. I rapped on the panel beside the driver's seat. It slid back with a grating noise, and the moustached face of Louise's coachman peered down at me.
Madame.
Left, I said, to l'Hôpital des Anges. Mother Hildegard tapped her blunt fingers thoughtfully on a sheet of music paper, as though drumming out a troublesome sequence. She sat at the mosaic table in her private office, across from Herr Gerstmann, summoned to join us in urgent council.
"Well, yes," said Herr Gerstmann doubtfully. "Yes, I believe I can arrange a private audience with His Majesty, but you are certain that your husband,
The music master seemed to be having unusual trouble in expressing himself, which made me suspect that petitioning the King for Jamie's release might be just a trifle more complicated than I had thought. Mother Hildegard verified this suspicion with her own reaction.
"Johannes!" she exclaimed, so agitated as to drop her usual formal manner of address. "She cannot do that. After all, Madame Fraser is not one of the court ladies." She is a person of virtue.
Thank you, I said politely. If you don't mind, though, what precisely would my state of virtue have to do with my seeing the king to ask for Jamie's release? The nun and the singing master exchanged looks in which horror at my naivete was mingled with a general reluctance to remedy it. At last, Mother Hildegard, braver of the two, bit the bullet.
If you go alone to ask such a favour from the king, he will expect to lie with you, she said bluntly. After all the carrying on over telling me, I was hardly surprised, but I glanced at Herr Gerstmann for confirmation, which he gave in the form of a reluctant nod.
His Majesty is susceptible to requests from ladies of a certain personal charm, he said delicately, taking a sudden interest in one of the ornaments on the desk. But there is a price to such requests, added Mother Hildegard, not nearly so delicate. Most of the courtiers are only too pleased when their wives find royal favour. The gain to them is well worth the sacrifice of their wives' virtue.
The wide mouth curled with scorn at the thought, then straightened into its usual, grimly humorous line.
But your husband, she said, doesn't appear to me to be the sort who makes a complacent cuckold.
The heavy, arched brows supplied the question mark at the end of the sentence, and I shook my head in response. I shouldn't think so. In fact, this was one of the grosser understatements I had ever heard. If complacent wasn't the very last word that came to mind at the thought of Jamie Fraser, it was certainly well down toward the bottom of the list. I tried to imagine just what Jamie would think, say, or do if he ever learned that I had lain with another man, up to and including the King of France. The thought made me remember the trust that had existed between us, almost since the day of our marriage, and a sudden feeling of desolation swept over me. I shut my eyes for a moment, fighting illness, but the prospect had to be faced.
Well, I said, taking a deep breath, is there another way?
Mother Hildegard knitted her brows, frowning at Herr Gerstmann, as though expecting him to produce the answer. The little music master shrugged, though, frowning in his turn.
If there were a friend of some importance who might intercede for your husband with his majesty, he asked tentatively.
Not likely. I had examined all such alternatives myself in the coach from Fontainebleau, and had been forced to conclude that there was no one whom I could reasonably ask to undertake such an ambassage. Owing to the illegal and scandalous nature of the duel, for of course Marie d'Orbonville had spread her gossip all over Paris, none of the Frenchmen of our acquaintance could very well afford to take an interest in it. Monsieur Duveny, who had agreed to see me, had been kind but discouraging. Wait, had been his advice. In a few months, when the scandal has died down a bit, then His Majesty might be approached, but now... Likewise, the Duke of Sandringham, so bound by the delicate proprieties of diplomacy that he had dismissed his private secretary for only the appearance of involvement in scandal, was in no position to petition Louis for a favour of this sort. I stared down at the inlaid tabletop, scarcely seeing the complex curves of enamel that swept through abstractions of geometry and colour. My forefinger traced the loops and whorls before me, providing a precarious anchor for my racing thoughts. If it was indeed necessary for Jamie to be released from prison in order to prevent the Jacobite invasion of Scotland, then it seemed that I would have to do the releasing, whatever the method, and whatever its consequences. At last I looked up, meeting the music master's eyes. "I'll have to," I said softly. "There's no other way." There was a moment of silence. Then Herr Gerstmann glanced at Mother Hildegard.
"She will stay here," Mother Hildegard declared firmly. "You may send to tell her the time of the audience, Johannes, once you have arranged it."
She turned to me.
"After all, if you are really set upon this course, my dear."
Her lips pressed tightly together, then opened to say,
"It may be a sin to assist you in committing immorality.
Still, I will do it. I know that your reasons seem good to you, whatever they may be. And perhaps the sin will be outweighed by the grace of your friendship.
Oh, Mother. I thought I might cry if I said more, so contented myself with merely squeezing the big, work-roughened hand that rested on my shoulder. I had a sudden longing to fling myself into her arms and bury my face against the comforting black serge bosom, but her hand left my shoulder and went to the long jet rosary that clicked among the folds of her skirt as she walked.
"I will pray for you," she said, smiling what would have been a tremulous smile on a face less solidly carved.
Her expression changed suddenly to one of deep consideration.
"Though I do wonder," she added meditatively, "exactly who would be the proper patron saint to invoke in the circumstances?"
Mary Magdalene was the name that came to mind as I raised my hands overhead in a simulation of prayer, to allow the small wicker dress frame to slip over my shoulders and settle onto my hips. Or Martha Hari, but I was quite sure she'd never make the calendar of saints. I wasn't sure about the Magdalene, for that matter, but a reformed prostitute seemed the most likely among the heavenly host to be sympathetic to the venture being now undertaken. I reflected that the convent of the angels had probably never before seen a robing such as this, while the postulants, about to take their final vows, were most splendidly arrayed as brides of Christ, red silk and rice powder probably didn't figure heavily in the ceremonies. Very symbolic, I thought, as the rich scarlet folds slithered over my upturned face. White for purity, and red for whatever this was. Sister Minerve, a young sister from a wealthy noble family, had been selected to assist me in my toilette. With considerable skill and aplomb, she dressed my hair, tucking in the merest scrap of ostrich feather trimmed with seed pearls. She combed my brows carefully, darkening them with small lead combs, and painted my lips with a feather dipped in a pot of rouge. The feeling of it on my lips tickled unbearably, exaggerating my tendency to break into unhinged giggles. Not hilarity. Hysteria. Sister Minerve reached for the hand mirror. I stopped her with a gesture. I didn't want to look myself in the eye. I took a deep breath and nodded. "I'm ready," I said. "Send for the coach." I'd never been in this part of the palace before. In fact, after the multiple twists and turnings through the candle-lit corridors of mirrors, I was no longer sure exactly how many of me there were, let alone where any of them were going. The discreet and anonymous gentleman of the bedchamber led me to a small panelled door in an alcove. He rapped once, then bowed to me, whirled, and left without waiting for an answer. The door swung inward, and I entered. The king still had his breeches on. The realization slowed my heartbeat to something like a tolerable rate, and I ceased feeling as though I might throw up any minute. I didn't know quite what I had been expecting, but the reality was mildly reassuring. He was informally dressed, in shirt and breeches, with a dressing gown of brown silk draped across his shoulders for warmth. His Majesty smiled and urged me to rise with a hand under my arm. His palm was warm. I had subconsciously expected his touch to be clammy, and I smiled back as best I could. The attempt must not have been altogether successful, for he patted my arm kindly and said,
"Don't be afraid of me, chère madame. I don't bite."
"No," I said, "of course not."
He was a lot more poised than I was. "Well, of course he is," I thought to myself. "He does this all the time."
I took a deep breath and tried to relax.
"You will have a little wine, madame?" he asked.
We were alone. There were no servants. But the wine was already poured in a pair of goblets that stood on the table, glowing like rubies in the candlelight. The chamber was ornate but very small, and aside from the table and a pair of oval-backed chairs, held only a luxuriously padded green velvet chaise longue. I tried to avoid looking at it as I took my goblet with a murmur of thanks.
"Sit, please."
Louis sank down upon one of the chairs, gesturing to me to take the other.
"Now, please," he said, smiling at me, "tell me what it is that I may do for you."
My husband," I began, stammering a little from nervousness. "He's in the Bastille."
"Of course," the king murmured, "for dueling, I recall."
He took my free hand in his own, fingers resting lightly on my pulse.
"What would you have me do, chère madame? You know it is a serious offence. Your husband has broken my own decree."
One finger stroked the underside of my wrist, sending small tickling sensations up my arm. Yes, I understand that. But he was provoked. I had an idea. "You know he's a Scot. Men of that country are..." I tried to think of a good synonym for berserk. "Most fierce, where questions of their honour are concerned." Louis nodded, head bent in apparent absorption over the hand he held. I could see the faint greasy shine to his skin and smell his perfume. Violets. A strong, sweet smell, but not enough to completely mask his own acrid maleness. He drained his wine in two long swallows and discarded the goblet, the better to clasp my hand in both his own. One short-nailed finger traced the lines of my wedding ring with its interlaced links and thistle blossoms.
"Quite so," he said, bringing my hand closer as though to examine the ring. "Quite so, madame. However..."
"I'd be most grateful, Your Majesty," I interrupted. His head rose, and I met his eyes, dark and quizzical. My heart was going like a trip-hammer. "Most grateful." He had thin lips and bad teeth. I could smell his breath, thick with onion and decay. I tried holding my own breath, but this could hardly be more than a temporary expedient.
"Well,"
he said slowly, as though thinking it over.
"I would myself be inclined toward mercy, madame."
I released my breath in a short gasp, and his fingers tightened on mine in warning.
"But you see, there are complications."
"There are," I said faintly. He nodded, eyes still fixed on my face. His fingers wandered lightly over the back of my hand, tracing the veins.
"The Englishman who was so unfortunate as to have offended Milor Brochturach," he said. "He was in the employ of a certain man, an English noble of some importance."
"Sandringham." My heart lurched at the mention of him, indirect as it was.
"This noble is engaged in, shall we say, certain negotiations which entitled him to consideration."
The thin lips smiled, emphasizing the imperious prow of the nose above.
"And this nobleman has interested himself in the matter of the duel between your husband and the English Captain Randall. I'm afraid he was most exigent in demanding that your husband suffer the full penalty of his indiscretion, madame."
Bloody tub of lard, I thought. Of course, since Jamie had refused the bribe of a pardon, what better way to prevent his involving himself in the Stuarts' affairs than to ensure Jamie's staying safely jugged in the Bastille for the next few years? Sure, discreet, and inexpensive. A method bound to appeal to the Duke. On the other hand, Louis was still breathing heavily on my hand, which I took as a sign that all was not necessarily lost. If he wasn't going to grant my request, he could scarcely expect me to go to bed with him. Or if he did, he was in for a rude surprise. I girded my loins for another try. "And does Your Majesty take orders from the English?" I asked boldly. Louis's eyes flew open with momentary shock. Then he smiled wryly, seeing what I intended. Still, I had touched a nerve. I saw the small twitch of his shoulders as he resettled his conviction of power like an invisible mantle.
"No, madame, I do not," he said with some dryness. "I do, however, take account of